good to have you here this morning. We're going to continue our study of young faces of faith, looking at some young and relatively young people in Scripture and what they can teach us about faith. As has been typical today, we're looking at a positive example and a not-so-positive example. We're looking at Ruth for a positive example, and then the wife of Lot for our counterexample. But as we just start to think about that, what do those two women have in common? Help us understand why we're talking about the two of them together. I have to stop and think about that for a minute. Moab, well, yeah, there's that. Okay. Pretty good. Chris?
They both had to leave their homeland.
Okay, all right. Both of them are put in positions where they are asked to leave behind the home that they've come to know and be familiar with, and I dare say love, for something entirely different. Their differing reactions to that are kind of what we want to be considering this morning. So let's start with our negative example. We've been trying to start with the positive ones. We're going to start with our negative ones, which means we actually get to go in the order of the questions today. Number one, we're looking in Genesis chapter 19 at the story of... So what's going on in Genesis chapter 19? Okay, all right. Remember, Lot has moved. When last we saw earlier in the narrative of Genesis, Lot had set up his tents in the vicinity of Sodom. Now he's actually living in the city of Sodom. And of course, Genesis highlights that the people of Sodom were very wicked sinners against God, so much so that Sodom and its sister city Gomorrah are going to be destroyed. The angels come to warn Lot and his family to escape. Because they don't want them. They want them to be spared that destruction. At first, just notice at first, verse 14, that Lot goes and speaks to his sons-in-law and tries to warn them. They think he's just joking. They don't take it seriously. Verse 15, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away in the punishment of the city. But what does verse 16 say? All right. Why? Why would Lot, why do you think, because the Bible doesn't really spell it out, but why would you think Lot might hesitate? Yeah, very good. This is where Lot and his family have made their life for some time. We don't know exactly how long. I don't think Genesis gives us an indicator of the precise time frame here. But this is where Lot has lived, has done business, has made connections, as Shane pointed out, quite possibly made friends or at least acquaintances that he cares about, even though he is very troubled by the sinfulness of the place. Sure.
Yeah,
His wife and daughters would probably feel the same way, especially for his daughters. This may be essentially the only home they've ever known, the environment they've ever known. We talk a lot, rightfully so, about the wisdom or the foolishness of Lot's decision to move to this area in the first place. But the point for today is that this is home. And now God is, through these angel messengers, urging them, you got to leave, and you got to leave right now, because the city is going to be destroyed, and we don't want you to be swept up in it. Any other thoughts about that? I mean, does that make sense, that why they might be reluctant to leave? So, verse 16 says, he hesitated, so the men seized his hand, and the hand of his wife, and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. When they had brought them outside, one said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away. And Lot pleads, no, let us find some little village close by, and not going to work. So Lot and his family have to be basically dragged out of the city, and they have to be led by the hand out of the city, and the angels say, you've got to get out of here. Don't hesitate. Don't stop at any of the little towns nearby. Don't wait in the valley. Get to the mountains right now, and don't look back. Okay? So they flee. Everybody knows this. What does Lot's wife do? All right? Why does everybody know that? Why is that the part of the story that we remember the most? Okay. Yeah, it's because of what happens to her when she looks back. Let me ask this. Again, the Bible doesn't say in so many words. Does her looking back possibly indicate something? We've already talked about their initial reluctance to leave, Lot's initial reluctance to leave the city. Is it possible that her looking back conveys a desire to go back? Yeah, and that's the point, right? Okay, yeah, that's the point the text of Genesis makes. You look back in disobedience to the word, Shane.
Well, you never traveled I-4. If someone's changing a tire on the opposite side of the road, everyone has to stop and look. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's human nature to stare at disaster. You see it back, people have to slow down and take a look. That's gonna human nature to be curious and whatnot. So when they heard the destruction going on, I mean, it's possible she may have just curiosity got the best of her.
Okay. Possible. All right. Our point is, as we're going to compare her to Ruth, she has an opportunity to start a new life at the direction of God, a new life of escape from the judgment that's come on Sodom. By the way, do you think part of the reason Lot might have hesitated and his family might have hesitated? And I'm just asking do you think questions because, again, Genesis just doesn't tell us. I think it's possible that part of what might have been going on in their heads is, see if this sounds familiar, if I leave, then I am in essence condemning everybody I leave behind. I'm acknowledging that they are sinners against God and have brought judgment on themselves by acting contrary to God's will, and that's not a happy feeling. Here's Lot. I sometimes liken Lot to people who are learning about the gospel and are confronted with what they need to do in response to the gospel. Yeah, but my beloved sainted grandmother didn't do that, and if I admit that this is what I need to do, then I'm condemning her. Well, you're really not in the strictest sense. But that's the way people often think. It's possible that if Lot had people he cared about in Sodom, certainly he had sons-in-law at the very least, we know they didn't leave with him, that he may have felt the same way. All right, somebody had a hand up. Good, yeah, Shane, go ahead. Right.
If they integrated into, you know, Sodom society, or if they were, you know, somewhere else, you know, but we have no record of them being saved. So
right.
Somewhere along the way, either they went their own, you know, their own way, or they were engulfed in what took place there.
Good point. Doit?
Maybe some tension between the fact that he hesitated, but Peter says that he was righteous and tormented his soul from day to day, seeing. What's interesting is that even when you see how bad things are, you still might hesitate. And I wonder, if the Lord were to say to us, I'm coming tomorrow, how many of us would still say, wait a minute. And I want to go, but give me a little more time.
Right.
I mean, that's just, maybe that's human nature, but even when you're righteous and the things around you bother you so much, you still might hesitate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. Somebody else?
Yeah. Just feel like yeah. He did not recognize the urgency
yeah.
at that moment of what he needed to do
right.
to get out of the city. And I don't know if that was his nature or just a mindset, but he just did not appear. It does not appear until he was, you know, taken by the hand. Mm-hmm. He got to get out. I mean, it was relayed to him that that mercy was just going to be extended for so long. And
right.
He refused. I mean, he had been caught up in the punishment as well. Mm-hmm. He just didn't act with the urgency that he needed to.
Right. Right. That, yeah, I think that's evident and certainly true of Lot's wife, not acting with the kind of urgency that she needs to. Okay, so here we got a situation where it's get out or you're going to die. There's hesitancy. And on the part of Lot's wife, there is a looking back, which again, in the strictest sense, violates what the angel warned them about, and may also indicate, you know, be an indicator of that hesitancy, maybe a desire to go back, a desire, you know, not to leave and to embrace the new blessings that God has in store for them. Now let's contrast that with our positive example today. Our challenge today is to talk about the story of Ruth without hitting all the details, because we've only got, you know, half an hour or so to do that. The story of Ruth is set in the period of the judges. That's important because it's a story of individual faithfulness set in a time of national faithlessness, when the people at large, not without exception, but a lot of the people just kind of were going their own way, doing their own thing, not paying attention to God. So our story begins with Elimelech, a Hebrew of Ephrathah, which an Ephrathite of Bethlehem. Ephrathah was kind of the ancient name of Bethlehem, may also have been one of the clan names of Judah. He and his wife Naomi go to sojourn in the land of Moab. Why do they do that? Okay. Wasn't because, hey, I hear Moab is nice this time of year, let's go take a vacation. There was a famine in the land of Israel. And so they went to the land of Moab. They had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They took wives for themselves from among the Moabite girls, Orpah and Ruth. In the course of time, Elimelech died, and some years later, it's actually after his death that it talks about the sons taking the wives, and then they died about 10 years later. So now you have Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth left. Remember, Naomi's an Israelite. Orpah and Ruth are Moabite girls who have been married to Israelite men. Verse 6, I think it is, says, and Naomi learned that God had shown kindness to Israel, and there was food again, and so she determines to go back to the land of Israel. What did she tell her daughters? Why did she want them to return to their own people in Moab? Okay. She tells them in essence, hey, I'm all out of sons. Too old anyway. Even if I were to get married and have children, you're going to wait for them to grow up and marry them? You know, kind of a reference to probably the levirate marriage practice of having a brother raise up children in the name of his brother who had passed. But anyway, she says, that's not an option. Go back to your own people. Get married. Have a life. And evidently with some reluctance, Orpah agrees to do that. What about Ruth? Ruth's not having it. What does she say to Naomi? And what does all that suggest to us about it? First of all, what does she say to Naomi?
Where do you go? I don't
know. Okay. All right. Classic language, right? Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. Okay. One of the questions before us is, does Ruth chapter 1 give us any indication about Ruth's conviction regarding the Lord? She's obviously got a powerful attachment to her mother-in-law. But what about God? Jane?
But she said, your God will be my God.
Okay. She says, your God will be my God. Now, that could be read as just, you know, hey, I love you, so whatever your religion is, I'll take that. Whatever gods you worship, I'll worship them. People did that in that day and age. Shane?
Well, it would be evident, unless Ruth was just, you know, a naive person or had an attachment disorder, that her time around Naomi had been a beneficial one, that it was, she had learned of God from her husband, from Naomi, from seeing, you know, all that they had done. You have to think that she knew God from the time that she had spent in that family.
Okay.
And I think the way that she talks about God and the Lord does not reflect any kind of idolatrous worship. I think she recognized a true God in her conversation with Naomi.
And if I think that's a reasonable assumption, and if that's the case, this Moabite girl is already way ahead of where an awful lot of the Israelite people are during the period of the Judges. Because a lot of them are treating the God of Israel as if he's just one of a multitude of gods from whom they can pick and choose. That's one of the defining problems of the Judges era. Okay? So much so that, you know, she will not be parted from Naomi. I think there are also some things you see as the story unfolds. There are things you witness in Ruth's character that I'm not sure can be explained any other way than that she has been influenced by the teaching about the God of Israel, about his expectations of people, in terms of how they treat one another, how they relate to one another. Other thoughts? Joy, go ahead.
I'd say the oddity of this is that Elimelech and Naomi are probably not doing what they should do. Mm-hmm. They're leaving the land, wanting to go take the land. Their sons are marrying climb the judges. Everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. They're still in some way reflecting that. And the fact that Ruth comes out where she does in spite of everything against her is, I think, the amazing part of the story.
It is. There's a lot of interesting... there's some difference of opinion among commentators about that. What Doyle raised, was Elimelech even doing the right thing by going to? Was that a betrayal of his trust in the God of Israel? And his sons marrying Moabite girls. What about that? We don't have time to delve into all those things, but to whatever extent there was failure on the part of Elimelech and his family, Ruth shows, here's this girl from a pagan background, a Moabite background, a nation with a history of hostility against the Israelites and animosity, and she's outdoing many of the Israelites in her character and in her devotion to her mother-in-law, presumably her devotion to God as well, so Lot's wife, get out or you're going to die. Get out of Sodom because the destruction is coming and we don't want you swept up in it. And she is unable to bring herself to follow the directions and get out for whatever complex reasons might be there. Ruth, Naomi says, I'm going back to Israel and to God's people. You go to your own people. You go back to the Moabites. Get married. Have a life. And Ruth insists, no, I'm going to leave it all behind. She's about to leave behind the country she grew up in. She's about to leave behind her relatives, her blood relatives, her culture. And she's going to move to Israel. If it were another area besides the judges, this point might be a little more salient. But you think all the Israelites are going to have a positive view of this Moabite girl who has come back with Elimelech's widow? Come back with that pagan Moabite girl in tow? What's up with it? Maybe not. Maybe some of the Israelites didn't care because it is the period of the judges. But Jane? So in chapter 2, we're introduced to Boaz. Who's Boaz? Okay. He is a relative of Elimelech, Naomi's late husband. That is important to the development of the story. He's described as a mighty kinsman of Naomi's husband. That might refer to his strength or his wealth or his status, probably the latter. And he's got fields, and he sees Ruth out there gleaning in his fields. Remember that the Israelites had provisions in the law. When you're harvesting your crops, you leave the edges of the fields for the poor so they'll have something to eat. Ruth and Naomi are both widowed women. Okay, that's their status. And Ruth being the younger, she's the one out there gleaning in the fields. And Boaz says, who is that girl? He inquires of his foreman. He learns who Ruth was. Chapter 2, verse 7. She had asked, please let me glean in the fields after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she has come and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a while. That, depending on how it's translated, might indicate that she had been diligently gleaning all day, except for a brief rest, or that she'd been patiently waiting all day for an answer from Boaz about this permission. In either case, dedication, persistence. Why is Ruth out there gleaning in the fields? Well, she's trying to provide for herself, but who else is she trying to provide for? Naomi. Okay. Is that the conduct you would, just knowing what you know about the history of Israel with the Moabites, is that what you would expect a Moabite to do? No. But that's how she behaves. So Boaz instructs Ruth to glean from his field and no other. My field. You stick with my field. You remain with my maids. You follow them. I've told my servants not to bother you, not to harass you. You are free to drink from the servants' water jars. At mealtime, he invites her to sit and eat with the reapers. He instructs the servants even to let her glean among the sheaves and even intentionally leave some behind for her. Let some fall to the ground so she can pick it up. And all that's going above and beyond the legal obligation that the law created for people, to the poor people gleaning in their fields. He is making extra sure that she's got plenty to pick up, plenty to provide for herself. She says, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" What does Boaz say? That's her question in verse 10. What does Boaz say to her in verse 11? This is important because it tells us something he has noticed about her. What does Boaz say in verse 11? Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, he has been informed because he acquired office. But what kind of girl is this anyway? And he was told how she had left her family behind after the death of her husband, and how she had followed her mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And in verse 12, I think it's very telling. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Mm-hmm. And so, how did she know about God? I think it was all through Naomi's good instruction. Mm-hmm. She was in a sense as her mother, mm-hmm. being her mother-in-law, and she saw an obligation. She had to try to teach her about the God of heaven. And that's what she did, I believe. And it did stick with her.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Anybody else? The text doesn't go into exactly how Boaz finds out about this, but he does. He knows her character. And again, he said, I think what Wayne said about verse 12 is important. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. By the way, that last expression is kind of important because it comes up a little later in the story in a different context. But as Boaz sees it, and again, we're not told all the ins and outs of what's on Ruth's mind all the time, or what she, to what extent she had been taught. We're just left to make summations about that. But as Boaz sees it, she has come to take refuge in God. He is impressed that she has left behind her people, her homeland, her family, and she's come, to this whole new world, as it were, and sought refuge in God. It's not just, as Boaz sees it, it's not just, I know you love your mother-in-law so much, and that's why you left. There's more to it than that, as he describes it. All right. And there's a little bit more in chapter 2 about Boaz's kindness to Ruth. When Naomi hears about this, it gets her attention. Why do you think she's takes notice of this? Well, because she knows who Boaz is. And she knows if anybody is in a position to marry Ruth and provide for Ruth and for her, and carry on their family. It's Boaz. So what does she suggest to Ruth that she needs to do? Again, I know we're trying to summarize this story really quickly. There's a lot of really neat little details that I wish we had more time to talk about. But anyway, what does Naomi tell Ruth she should do? Okay, all right.
Which is in the tent, which he wakes up, finds out who she is, and says, okay, there's a kingdom of Redeemer closer to me than you in the town. Let me go find out if you'd like to redeem this thing. If not, I will do it.
Okay, all right. Good summary, all right. Yeah, Shane?
Okay.
It is interesting. Look at verse 3. Naomi tells Ruth, wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your best clothes, go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do. I'll tell you, among commentators for a long, long time, there have been two ways of looking at what Naomi is telling Ruth to do. One is a very innocent interpretation. The other, not so much. One is, what I guess, what most of us think of. Go down there and present yourself to him, reveal who you are. He knows the situation. Make an appeal to him, and he'll tell you what to do. The other possibility that has been suggested is that Naomi is essentially saying to Ruth, go down there and do what Moabite women do. She's essentially telling her to go down and seduce Boaz. The terms that are used in verses 3 and 4 could be interpreted in that way. Many interpreters have understood it in that way. Here's the point, without worrying about which interpretation is correct as far as, because that obviously reflects on Naomi's character and motivation a little bit. What ends up happening? Does Ruth go down there and seduce Boaz sexually? All right. In fact, one of our questions asked, are there things that Ruth and Boaz both do to kind of protect the appearance of the situation? What are some of the things that happen?
Well, it says don't be protected.
All right. That's all right. By the way,
And he knows he probably wants to do that. He kind of convinced him not to do that. So there's kind of an innocent master plan of this whole thing.
Okay.
Like Shane said, he did his homework. He knew who he was.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's good. Okay. Somebody else? I know we're trying to summarize the story, and we love this story, and we love all the details of this story. We studied Joshua and Judges and Ruth not terribly long ago and talked about a lot of the details in this. But Boaz, without hesitation, understands and responds to what she is. She is essentially proposing marriage in a reverse kind of way. And he says, we've got to observe the legal niceties. There is a kinsman redeemer who is a closer relative than I. He has the right of refusal. He should be the first to be approached by this. And Boaz says, I'll take care of that. And if not, there's no wondering what's going to happen. I will take care of it. Doy, you were going to say, no, okay. I was waiting for an insightful comment from Doy, and I just misunderstood it. Go ahead, Shane. Get an insightful comment from Shane. Oh, well, all right. Yeah, I think in a way, just about everything she does here is a gesture of submissiveness toward him, and also a gesture that is meant to appeal to him. Yeah. So in the ensuing verses, Boaz, David already alluded to this. Boaz approaches the other kinsman, okay, and that expression. The expression, some of our translations have kinsman redeemer. It's a particular Hebrew term that a person who has the right and many would have said the responsibility of acting for the good of, in this case, Ruth and Naomi in the name of his deceased relative Elimelech. And a lot of these things were in place so that family lines and clans would not die out, and their heritage of land would be preserved also. And remember, in Naomi's case, if this doesn't happen, where does that leave her? Oh, and Ruth too, but especially Naomi. Where does that leave her? Yeah, it leaves her as a destitute widow, at the mercy of the generosity of others, from now on. So here's a great opportunity. Really interesting thing that transpires, and this is all going on at the city gate because it's a legal proceeding, and Boaz presents this and talks about the inheritance and the land. Oh, that all sounds good. Oh, by the way, Ruth is part of the bargain. Got to marry Ruth. Oh, well, I can't do that. And so again, they observe the legal requirements. And the other kinsman recuses himself from this duty. I'm summarizing this in a very, very brief way. And that leaves Boaz to take Ruth as wife and make this provision. And all the people who are present as witnesses are giving recognition to that. And it dropped down to verse 13 of... Sorry, verse 11 of chapter 4. All the people who were in the court, all the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah." Why invoke Rachel and Leah in this blessing? Actually, they explain it, in case we were wondering. Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. All right? That's Jacob's two wives. Okay? They're responsible for a large portion of his son. They and their handmaidens gave birth to all his sons. That's the origin of the nation of Israel. May God make you like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built, and may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. And Perez is Boaz's ancestor. Through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. So Boaz takes Ruth and the rest, as they say, is history. Now, something Shane already alluded to. They mentioned Tamar. Rahab from Book of Joshua Tamar, from Genesis, was it chapter 37? And Ruth all find their way into the genealogy of Jesus, the family history of Jesus, in Matthew chapter 1. Rahab, where was she from? Okay, she was a Canaanite woman from Jericho and a harlot to boot. And yet, because of her exercise of faith in God, she becomes part of the family line of David and then of Jesus. Tamar, Judah's daughter-in-law, kind of a sordid story, but she manipulates things in such a way as to expose a lack of integrity in Judah's own character, and he gets the point, and she becomes part of the family line of David, and then of course Ruth, who's from a Moabite background. By the way, this wasn't in our question. There's one more woman, or four women in that who appear in that family history of Jesus: Rahab, Tamar, Ruth. Remember who the fourth one is? Somebody said it. It's Bathsheba. And all four of those women, what we read about them in the Old Testament, there's some shade thrown on the situation, either because of their background or because of some aspect of their character or something. And yet all four of them are in the ancestry of Jesus. These three women that we've already talked about, of course, Bathsheba becomes David's wife. Ruth becomes, what is David's great-grandmother, I think? Okay. So with all that said, what do we learn by contrasting Lot's wife with Ruth? What do we learn about faith that we need to put to work? That's really the question. I've left us 60 seconds to talk about it. So here we go. Let's hear it. What were both of these women asked or presented with the opportunity to do?
Obey God's commands.
Okay. Obey God's commands. What did that involve for both of them? It involved leaving behind essentially everything they'd known, at least in recent memory. For Ruth, it meant leaving behind her home country, her home relatives, her home culture. For Lot's wife, we don't know how long she had been with Lot, prior to moving to Sodom, all those details. But this is the life she's known for a while. This is what she's gotten used to. This is evidently what she is comfortable with. And now she's being asked to leave it behind because it's all about to be wiped off the face of the earth. Two very different reactions to that. What does that have to do with you and me? Okay. We are presented with choices all the time. Many of those choices have a very important spiritual dimension to them. And sometimes we're confronted, with, if I'm going to do the right thing, it means leaving behind a lot, maybe a lot that's meant a great deal to me, or that's had a big impact on me. What am I going to do about that? Am I going to follow God's direction, meaning what God has revealed in His will, or not? That's the question. We're going to talk a little more about that in our sermon this morning, actually, in some different contexts. Thanks for considering these two women with us this morning, and we'll pick up with our next lesson Wednesday night.